Welcome to the Great Security Debate. This show has experts taking sides to help broaden understanding of a topic. Therefore, it's safe to say that the views expressed are not necessarily those of the people we work with or for. Heck, they may not even represent our own views, as we take a position for the sake of the debate. Our website is greatsecuritydebate.net, and you can contact us via email at feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net or on Twitter @securitydebate. Now, let's join the debate already in progress.
But circling back to what you guys were talking about in regards to the lifespan, right,
yeah,
of somebody. And Dan, I was reading your article in, or the what you had sent over, and part of it made me think also, Eric, when you made the comment, Brian, how long have you been there? And I said, a year and 9 months. And you go, okay, so you got about another year, and then you'll rotate.
It was all planned.
And but there's some truth to that too. Like there's the builders, right? Like to help build up programs, but maybe they're not great at managing people. And I'm not going to say I'm bad at managing people, but I do know in a prior career, I did struggle for a few years when I moved up into a management role and I was younger, trying to manage people that were either older or had families. And here I didn't have that, right? So until you have a family, until you have those things and other responsibilities, I never really understood why somebody had to leave early today because of this, or why somebody was late coming in, right? And one of my close friends that I worked with over there too, had really was one of the guys that sat me down to kind of explain it, you know? And he was like, you should come over to my house and have dinner with the family. I was like, yeah, I'd love to do that. And then you do that and you see like, oh, this is a lot, you know, like there's a lot of work outside of work that you have that I don't have. Right. So put some of that in perspective, but like you said, Eric, the CISO lifespan, right, when people say, oh, well, there's a lot of turnover at the top, not that CISOs are being necessarily let go, but they transition to other companies. They build up programs. Uh-huh. Yeah. And I think it was Helen that went to Duo from Ohio State University.
Yeah.
When you read hers, too, it talked about that as well. There's, you know, you accomplish everything that you set out, maybe accomplish more than you even planned. But there's part of that that you really enjoy doing. And you want to take that either A to the next level or to another organization to continue to grow them and support them.
And that's just it. That's it. You got to break down. There's different types of CISOs that thrive under different environments. And,
yep,
and Dan, I think I'm learning more and more now, having made this change, I'm more in your camp as well, that I want to build it. And as long as there is still changing dynamics of the enterprise where it's going, there's more to do. Yep. I'm cool.
Yeah,
I don't want to be in one of those days where it's like lost. What do you do every day? Well, I push the red button.
Exactly.
Why do you push the red button? I don't know. I was just told this is what I do.
By now, it's just, yeah, I wake in, I do this, and that's what I do.
And there's nothing wrong, but there's nothing wrong with that.
No. There needs to be, and there are people who are extremely good at operationalizing and running and optimizing an organization. And they rue many things that we do. Because the things we do are way more seat of our pants, way more, you know,
right.
It's different styles for different folks. Like I know some of the best operations people and they hate doing what I do because their world is method, reliability, predictability.
So I wonder if like from a manufacturing space, I remember when Crocs got popular, Beanie Babies got popular. Will
sorry, Crocs are never the answer.
Eric's probably laughing because he's seen my orange Crocs at the house that say kitchen on them. Like people ask, like, why do those say kitchen? I'm like, because I also have another orange pair that I wear outside.
You can't confuse the two orange pairs of Crocs. Crocs are never the answer. Actually, it's not true. Crocs make the best reef walking shoes.
Oh, I can see that.
What I was gonna say though was, at some point, will the red button become a highly manufactured item? Easy button.
So let's double click into that, Brian. Are you talking about the easy button from setting up tools and setting up components of the program? Are you talking about the easy button from an operational standpoint, that it's a well-oiled machine and we just have to watch it to make sure it's still humming along?
I'm going with the latter.
Okay.
Right? That's what I would be referring to. But I think when people hear that, they're like, okay, well, what tools do I need to buy that are the easy button, right? And we had a conversation around like what was dubbed the SOC triad, which I think is kind of changing again, where people say, Gartner said, here's the SOC triad. You had the SIM or the EDR, the NDR, and the SIM. And a lot of companies looked at that and said, okay, well then which ones do I need to buy? And then after they buy these, they're like, okay, now how do I operationalize this? Well, we can't do this. I need to hire somebody else. So now they're buying managed services or somebody to be able to manage it or put that together for their program. And then it's, I bought three things that maybe don't even play well together.
Right.
And so I think when people hear that term easy button, it's not buying an easy button from the idea that this product's an easy button, this product's an easy button. It's how do you operationalize what products your environment needs, and then what tools this number of people can actually manage.
Right.
Right. Because not everybody has, like we talked about before, a 24/7 SOC. Not everybody right. has, you know, 10 really experienced security engineers. And this even goes further back then when we talk about the type of groups in the state of Michigan, like WMSA, like MCWT, really trying to push the initiative from tech and security to get more people looking at the space, training in the space. And then the same comments come up that goes back to another podcast we had of, well, then what should people be doing to get into the space, right? Is it certifications? Is it experience, or is it a college degree?
This is great. We now have enough episodes that we are referencing ourselves for material. It's like a circular reference. Well, we said it before, so it must be true now. Absolutely.
But this is the modern internet in play. If I can refer to something that was on the internet, then I now have the definitive proof.
Gentlemen, we made it.
Singularity.
Yeah. No, so think about it. I think that's a great point, Brian. And I kind of think about this, and I'm surprised you didn't jump in here with the manufacturing kind of analogy, that as we look at the evolution of the Dad's over here laughing now. As we look at the evolution of the maturity of the program, you hand off to almost a Six Sigma guy. Or gal, doesn't matter. And that's when you start getting into, we're going to finely tune it. So if we think about it, think about it from a framework perspective, right? When you're building a new program, you have a loose tie to frameworks. You might pull a little bit from COBIT, you might pull a little from CIS, from ISO, from all different places, because you're trying to build the foundational items. But as you transition to that maturity item, now you're starting to get into, I am going to pick one. And then it starts transitioning into being kind of a business differentiator, and it's tightening the screws on the different areas, making sure that you've got tight documentation, processes, and all of those things. And there's certainly a place for those CISOs that can come in and do that. There's a large contingent of CISOs that just don't have the attention span to get into some of those frameworks, and those frameworks are really important.
Right. And I am going to try and find, there was some good research, some good Forrester research a few years ago. Jeff Pollard, I think, was behind it around. There's some definitive types of CISOs, the transformational CISO, the transformational CISO, the post-breach CISO, and then, yeah, some more of the run the organization type CISOs. I will find the link and then we can talk.
The post-breach CISO has to come in with a theme song though, right? Like that's a requirement.
And a hard hat.
I think there's a difference too between when you say like a post-breach CISO, right? And pre-breach CISO, because typically the post-breach CISO is getting a larger budget to go handle what is now perceived as a larger problem or a bigger risk. I put up into the comments an article I just read the other day, and I thought it was pretty cool. It says how to quantify cyber risk in a somewhat simple way. And I looked at it and I said, you know, this is really good. This is something that even I would use myself when trying to put together and talk about how do you differentiate in an environment, you know, between different operating systems, between server, desktop, laptop, you know, overall risk. And it was interesting to see the way those risks were formulated. But then even going back to, was it a week now? Has it been a week and a half? Week since the Senate hearings. And there was one senator in particular that asked a question to everybody and he said, all I want is a yes or no answer. And Dan, I 100% was thinking of you. And if there was a point where like a listener could come in and say, yes, it depends, right? It was the it depends button. And he asked the question, he said, you know, I have been talking to these government organizations, you know, and I was working directly with the IRS. And the IRS said they were not impacted because their servers were not connected to the network. He goes that they were not connected to the internet. He goes, and NIST says that there's a framework for how to use firewalls. And if you're using that firewall appropriately and we're not connected, they were safe. They were safe. So I want to know, do you guys agree with these frameworks? Yes or no? And that's all I want. And he starts with Kevin Mandia and Kevin says, well, sir, he goes, it depends. I'm going to have to say it depends. And he goes, I need a yes or no. He goes, well, it's not black or white. He goes, well, I agree with the frameworks. He goes, the reality is I can have 600 pen testers, you know, 600 pen tests a year that all find a way around that same exact scenario that you're playing out. He goes, it's just the reality of the way things work. And he started diving into it. He goes, okay, so I'm going to put you more on the no category. He goes, right? And he goes down the line. And I just thought it was somewhat comical because you can put together frameworks, right? But the reality is, how do these work inside my environment? And I think we've all said this before. There's no such thing as a silver bullet. You can't say, well, if I do this, and this. Right. I mean, at the end of the day, unplug everything. Right. And just don't use the technology, you're safe. Well, then how are we moving forward with our digital transformation? How are we doing this? So, and then it comes down to also budget. Like,
right.
So the post-breach CISO and the pre-breach CISO are definitely two different hats along with two different purses.
Well, and one is incident response mindset is a very different than strategic planning. So I found the reference. So it was Paul McKay, Jeff Pollard, and Janan Budge from Forrester last year. The six types: transformational CISO, a post-breach CISO, tactical and operational expert CISO, compliance and risk guru, steady state CISO, and a customer-facing evangelist. And I think those are six very different, very dynamically different types of roles. One might even say that an organization should have some componentry of all six of those at any given time.
I really agree with that statement, Dan. But that also gets back into just leadership in general and understanding as a CISO, as any leader, we'll leave it generically as a leader, what are your strengths? What are not your strengths? And those opportunity areas where maybe you're not as strong, not your focus areas, is where you're hiring. You're hiring to surround yourself. It's the idea of when you get in a meeting, you don't have to have all of the answers. You're surrounding yourself with people that you can trust that have those answers that you can lean upon. And that's a maturity item of a leader. And in this case, of a CISO, of realizing this is typically where I thrive. This is what I do. Those other areas, I got to bring that with me.
Right. And you can go back, you can even at a more parochial, more basic fundamental level, there were in my day, my days in banking, there were people who were change the bank people and there were people who were run the bank people. And they were two very different approaches. And though when you'd get to the end of a change the bank program, it would typically end up being a different type of person, a different staff, to run the bank.
And that's why I think it's really important to have a CISO that what we talked about before is understanding the business that your organization is in. Because when going to ask for budgets, right? Whether or not I was in security today or when I was in automotive yesterday, the same was true. If I went in to ask for something, right, I would have to explain why I needed it. And the why I needed it, a lot of times I was either trying to show how I'm saving us X amount of money in this budget fiscal year or over 2 or 3 years, or B, how much money we are going to make, right? Because that's what they cared about. It was more bottom line. And that was always either in the very beginning of my presentation or at the very end, depending on who I was talking to, knowing that I might only have 5 minutes with this executive, it was in the beginning. If I was inside a large meeting room, it was in the end. So it wrapped everything up and everybody went home with that information and came back to make a decision. So the worst, I won't say the worst part, the toughest part, I think, about the security side of it. And I'm trying to see where I pulled this from. I was reading this a week ago, or maybe I was listening to it. And actually, no. I think I was listening to it. I think it was part of the Senate hearings as well, where they explained, you have to understand that when you look at, it talked about risk and it talked about, you know, I think it was entry point for people, that there's a skills need, right? And at the end of the day, organizations, you know, when they decide, yes, we're going to put security people in place, it's not just that there's not enough people in security. It's there hasn't been necessarily a business need when people looked at it from the sense of, am I willing to spend X amount of money, mm-hmm. bring in right. X amount of people? What does this do to our bottom line? And I think, Dan, this goes back to the messaging that we were talking about before we started the show, in terms of there's people that come in and build, right, and then move on. There's people that, and right now security is very much, I think, in a building standpoint, where people see it as part of the business now, and they need to build a program with the business. It's not just a being reactive, and there's still a lot of organizations out there being reactive, but you have to build it, but there's a cost associated to that. So being able to show the business then what the cost avoidance is, right, for the future impact or risk avoidance, I think is really important, because post-breach CISO, I think it's pretty easy to show what the risk is. Here's what it cost us, or here's all the stuff we had to rebuild, or here was the money we paid out, or here was the lost production, is pretty easy to see, but it's not as tangible if it's never occurred yet, right? If you're still there saying, what if?
But it's also not as tangible. You know, we're, for better or worse, the people now are living with the sins of those of us who have been in the industry for, you know, for a long time, for 25 years, the fear, uncertainty, and doubt approach to selling security was the norm. If you don't do this, Dateline 1999, if you don't buy this new firewall, hackers will get in. And, and that prevailed for a very long time. And when things didn't happen, the proof of a negative is a very difficult thing. But the fact that it didn't happen, the fact that generally we got through Y2K, we spent a ton of money on Y2K. You know what? Nothing happened. And those of us on the side of working, that had worked on it, meant that we did what we needed to. But those that look at it from the outside say, well, did we just invest in nothing? But the reality is that it's hard to keep going to that fear, uncertainty, and doubt well. And I think there's an even more important pivot that has to happen toward business value, not just risk avoidance. And I think far too many people in information security today still have not made that leap toward how can security and privacy be part of making us more money, making us more trust, building trust and confidence in the business, which ergo leads to, being able to sell more widgets or do more services, and still are focused on just the tech, just the avoidance, just the risk portion of it without that last translation layer. And I think that's starting to become a disservice to, the long-term, not viability, but the long-term mindset of those that are funding security programs. Because, you said it yourself, Brian, security is part of business now. It is a must. Things have to be placed into SEC documents when you have material security risks. They are risks. They are part of the business. And we as a field should be spending more time thinking about that and talking in those terms. And I don't think we're quite there yet. I'd say we're probably 30% of the way there. This is the next transformation of information security.
With that, I really want to pose a question to both of you. And
the answer is it depends.
It does depend.
Hey, Dan, on that very topic, do you believe, I won't say do you believe, when it comes to vendors and resellers, do you believe they also pose a risk or a necessary evil slash need to organizations in A, how they sell, and how either A, they're overpromising? I'm going back to the idea that there's too many flashy, blinky, shiny buttons and lights. And the reason I'm asking this question is I'm on the vendor side, right? So I don't want to ask myself this, but
you're a sales guy?
Were you in automotive too?
So that is true. That is a yes.
It doesn't depend.
It does not depend. So what I want
to
put
to your actual question.
what I'm putting out there is, since I've been here and I realize that there are a ton of vendors, there are a ton of resellers, those are businesses and companies, and they have targets and quotas. Everybody's trying to sell, and there's a lot of marketing. There's a fine line, I think, between the idea of need versus want, right? And also trust and transparency.
Absolutely. And that's there is no, it depends about that. It is absolutely a must, and increasingly so. And I think that, you know, the way I heard your question in there was, our supplier, our vendors, our VARs, our resellers, is VAR actually a term still used? I don't know.
It is.
Is that okay?
I think a lot of them lost the value proposition.
Oh, you took my line. Yes.
Yeah.
So my answer is, those organizations, software suppliers to the security world, and I think this is way beyond just security. This is technology. Any kind of supplier needs to be able to define things in that same thing I just said, in terms of value to the business. Not just how I can stop this thing or how I can be the easy button for this piece of the process, but be able to extrapolate that all the way out into business value for my business value for my organization, and absolutely not focusing on why they're better than the other guy, but how they're going to help my business. We've come too far in this field to get caught up in, I'm better than this other vendor, and I'm better than this other vendor. And the discussion is bringing each of those organizations down, not helping me as a buyer, as the person who will ultimately use your awesome widget that is better than the other vendor, you say, to help my business. And I need to understand how it helps my business, how it helps my organization, how it helps me build trust. And that comes from transparency between the supplier and me. It comes through that builds trust, partnership. And I talk about this in the real term of the word partnership, where you're actually doing things give and take back together. We throw the word partnership out there very easily now. We're not you don't buy from us, we're partners. BS. 99.7% of the time, that's not the case. It's, I want you to buy more stuff. I want, as a CISO, I want more partnerships. I want to get to know you better. I want to get to know your product better. I want to have a hand in helping to shape that. And you are seeing leading security technology vendors do move toward this slowly but surely. But I think it has to continue. So did that answer your question, Brian?
Well, yes, I will say yes, and I want to hear Eric's too, because then I'm gonna pose another question back to you on that. And Dan, I agree with you. I really do.
Yeah. So to restate the question in a different way, are sellers posing a risk to organizations because of how they sell? And I think that it's a matrixed answer of ownership of risk to the paradigm that we've created in the selling market. Right. From an ownership perspective, right there with Dan, as a CISO, we own the risk of our organization, understanding our needs, what our actual threats are, and all of that. So we own, I think, the creation of the model that we're sitting in today of just buying and selling goods, right? Because it worked for so long. That's why it's still going on. That's why you're still getting cold called. That's why, I mean, it's obviously working somewhere. We created that. I own that. We own that. But at the same time, on the partnership, I think that's where it becomes matrix, right? There's an ownership that does fall on the selling organization to start creating those relationships. And this, you know, one of my pet peeves, and I'm seeing this more and more as, you know, like we kind of go back to Brian, you know, sales guys are only around 3 years and then they shift companies. That is a problem to partnerships. But at the same time, as CISOs, we tend to rotate as well. Totally, totally get that. But my biggest beef is not that the salespeople are moving, that the companies that they're moving from suck at creating the connection, connecting with the customer once they move on. I can't tell you how many, and I will call them partners because there's a lot of people in the sales community that I really, really like dealing with that have moved on and their email gets cut off right away. And I don't hear that they've moved on until I see it on LinkedIn or something else. And I get nothing from the company. That's not a partnership.
Which now tells you that back. It was the person that you were partnering with, not the organization.
Right.
I think, Dana, this is where I'll jump in, Eric, on your comment. Now that I'm here, I see that. I mean, I came from an organization where I worked there for almost 16 years. And since I've been here working for a security company, I hear all the time, you know, when I'm talking with people, but you know, nobody stays that long, right? And they're referring about 5 years, and I might be one of four people in the conversation. And when it comes to me, I'm like, actually, I was with my previous company for 16 years. And they're like, why? And this conversation has blossomed in terms of the number of different people in different verticals within IT that I've had the conversation with. And if there's one, I don't want to call it commonality or consistency I've seen, people start to move because the leadership continues to change. If they're not hitting numbers, they flip the leadership, bring in a new sales organization from the top management. That top management fires everybody or brings people in an effort to push other people out. Right. And so where I'm agreeing with you, Eric, is it becomes from a partnership side. If it was all about partnerships, then regardless of the management changes, you'd retain the people that have the relationships in those areas, right? With those customers you're working with. And if you're not going to, then you notify those customers to let them know, here's the changes that are being made. As soon as it's made, it should be in this. I think it's funny to look also, you mentioned that there's CISOs or directors, you know, that maybe move also every 2 to 3 years.
Actually, some new research says the average is about 4. We've been propagating the wrong statistic.
No, that's good information. Even from my side, I found it funny in terms of communication back from the enterprise side, because I've had two customers where the management had moved on or the key contact had moved on. And I go through my accounts quite regularly, and I had to reach out and say, just wanted to double check who the correct contact would be for, you know, notifications for this, et cetera. And they're like, oh yeah, that person hasn't been here for 4 months. Right. And it's like, guys, that's something I should know as well. You know, like I'm dealing with two people at this level, but if this person moved on and he was, you know, the person put in for like the emergency contact, right? That information should update. And I think, Eric, you'd probably say, well, Brian, you should know that as well. But to be able to manage, you know, 14, 20 accounts.
Was that my cue to say, Brian, you should know that as well?
That was the cue. But I am agreeing with you, Eric, and Dan, from what you said on your side. I also agree there as well. And some of this goes back to when you talk about, it's a business, right? You got to understand who you're selling into, the verticals, how you're actually helping their business. But I also think when you look at a post-breach CISO versus a pre-breach CISO, I look at the way people sell into that. And right away, it's not selling to the business and how you're going to help transform or support their business for the long term. It's here's how you can fix this immediate problem. This does it, and you have budget for it. You should buy it. And here's 5 more tools I can put on for, you know, once and only, you get this.
Well, right. I'll add to that. A lot of the times I think when that sales pitch comes in, it is framed in the context of, hey, we can solve your problems. But wait, we haven't had a conversation about what my problems are. So how do you know if you can fix those? I'll tell you, as we've been talking about this, I think the biggest difference for me between a partner and just another vendor is the phrase of somebody in the sales organization being able to utter the words, you know, that's not something we do real well. That is honesty, transparency, that once an organization can do that and acknowledge this is where we're great, but this is where, you know, there's better players in the space. Mm-hmm. Now we're at partnership level.
Totally. And so there's two things I want to bring up. Number one, the fact, so we talk a lot about CISO churn. And back to Jeff Pollard, seems like Jeff and the folks at Forrester have been on my mind lately. About 2 weeks ago, he posted a piece on debunking the CISO tenure myth. We all talk about, you know, CISOs are in 18 to 24 month cycles. It turns out that's not true. Despite the widely propagated belief that CISOs have an average tenure of 2 years, our data collected from Fortune 500 proves otherwise. Our CISO data demonstrates that CISO tenures fall in line with other C-level executives with a 4.2-year tenure. Other C-level executives average just a bit over 4 years, according to Korn Ferry. So, you know, reliable sources, a broad spectrum of types of companies. The average tenure of a CEO, 6.9 years. And I think that's a number we generally hear out in the world. People have gotten that one in their heads. CIOs, 4.6 years. CMOs, 4.1. CFOs, 4.7. And CISOs, 4.2. So the, you know, the interesting part is, you know, is we're not churning like everyone else does. It's also a really interesting point on the average age, the median age of those different roles. The CEO, 59. CIO 55, CMO 54, CFO 54, but the CISO, the average CISO age, 48. So this is a new, it's still a younger field. It's still something that's, you know, that's up and coming. But what it means is that one, that Eric hasn't peaked yet. and two, that, you know, that there is still some discrepancy in, you know, age, whether we like it or not. Age is still seen as a sign of progress or of viability in a role. And, you know, I would expect that there's some different, the way that those other slightly more mature roles look at the CISO. But long and short of it is 4.2 years. That's not 18 to 24 months.
Right.
CISOs are not jumping ship quite as vigorously as people want to believe.
So I want to go back. I was thinking about kind of where we were going. We were talking about the security program being a business differentiator and driving the business forward to drive in new business. And I want to take the counter to that, because I think there's a lot of verticals where, let's be honest, security matters behind the scenes as an earnings retention, but as a driving new sales, it doesn't. It's just not going to be there. If you think about it, I think it a lot of verticals that are B2C, it doesn't matter, because the consumer's looking for, I want something faster, I want it better, and I want it cheaper, right? As long as you hit those, and as long as you haven't had a breach in the recent history, and even actually, as we look at
even
the statistics,
even if you have,
yeah, look at Target, right? I mean, they took a dip for a little bit, and then it came back pretty strong. And actually, I mean, they've pivoted and done really well now. It has nothing to do with the breach, but it's very short-term mind in the customer realm, right? That I don't think the average consumer cares that much. And we've done this, we talked about this early on, that there's a lack of education on getting consumers into that mindset where they should care and understanding the long-term ramifications of what's going on. But in a B2C model, I don't know if it matters that much. B2B, certainly, because companies are asking the questions. Companies want to know now how secure you are, because you're now in my supply chain, and that security posture kind of goes, it's a domino effect up, right? So right. There you care, but I think there's still a lot of verticals where whereas, there, it's a checkbox.
Whereas we used to say that security and privacy wouldn't win you or lose you a deal, between, you know, in a B2B relationship. Now I think it's pretty clear that security will definitely lose, or lack of security will definitely lose you a deal. And now it might even get you the deal.
It, So one thing I was going to throw out there. So while I do absolutely agree with that, there's one area that I think is a differentiator, right? Where security can help the business move forward. And I'm going to try to explain that because I've been trying to explain that as of recent. But I think it's a tough conversation to have because I've noticed, and this where I'm going with this is the idea of how people are utilizing the cloud, how people are doing the whole micro segmentation, running workloads and applications in the cloud, using cloud compute power from their DevOps side, and how security can play in with that. As and this goes back to the idea of the Phoenix project, right? When we talked about what DevOps was and then adding the DevSecOps part of it. If you can put security tools in place for that DevOps team, not to hold them back, but to speed that up, or not necessarily speed it up, but it's the same on a manufacturing line, right? You put quality controls in place, but if those quality controls are somebody on the line manually checking and putting an X over the weld in this, you're slowing the overall line down, right? So your tack times, right, to produce that finished good go up. And in DevOps, it's the same thing. The speed at which you're able to perform, right, without slowing it down. And if you are slowing it down, by how much are we slowing it down? And the security tools that go in place that don't create issues with the DevOps team allow those production lines, if you want to call it that, to move forward. So I think that's one area of differentiation. Another thing, when you mentioned about Target and the idea that when you lose customer confidence, your stock could dip. And this goes back to the Senate hearings and the idea that do people need to come forward, right? And if they have a breach, publicly come out and say that. And I think everybody that was on the stand said there needs to be a way to confidentially give that information from a threat intel standpoint so it can be shared. But there's enough companies out there that wouldn't want to share if they don't have to, because like you said, their stock price could come down. It's part of the risk avoidance. If I don't have to tell, why tell? Because it could affect our overall bottom line. The link that I shared in regards to quantifying cyber risk, one of the notions it mentioned was you might have a set of premium customers. Let's say that your premium customers have a much higher customer value average of, let's say, $250 a month. And the laptop processed information for these premium users. Now that this particular laptop's breach value could be $260,000. 500 premium customers times 10% abandonment times 3,000 premium customer value per year plus $110,000 in records equals a massive loss if you lose a premium customer because of something that happened with their data, right? That's not saying the customer is in the consumer, the two of us, but you may have someone that uses your platform that no longer trusts you and they move away from you, right? That is a huge loss in business and you can put X dollars. That makes people not want to share when something bad does happen.
To a certain extent, though, some of those elements on the impact of an actual company are covered for public companies, right? Because anything that has a material impact on your business. So for instance, ransomware on a manufacturing line or something like that, or if it took down a system at a car manufacturer that may or may not say that there was ransomware or not, but their systems went down for a long time. I feel like that was in the news recently. You have to report some of those things, but I'll draw it back to, I think there is a fundamental issue in our industry on the gray area, the undefined, the looseness of the terms that we use. Breach, incident, hack, what do they actually mean? We get into definitions, we can pretty closely, we've gotten better at defining PII, that we can do now, right?
In the U.S.
In the U.S. We've grown a lot. But what constitutes something that I have to make publicly known is widely discretionary. And that becomes a problem. And I guess there is an element of legalese that needs to stay in the gray area. Because as soon as you make it so tightly focused, so locked down, as soon as you put it on the paper, it's outdated, right? I think there was the concept of the law of the horse, that you need to keep it a generic enough that it could dress a horse, a carriage, a car. It kind of expands as time goes on. But if you, in security, if you make something so strictly defined, it is so outdated by the time it gets signed in.
Right. And by the time you've gotten the education across, you know, back to the point about, you know, what is the definition of a breach? I don't know about you, Eric, but I've spent a lot of time in organizations helping non-technology people not use that word inappropriately, because right. as soon as you use the word breach, certain things start getting triggered.
There's ramifications to that word.
Exactly. And you know, but those kind, some of those basic fundamentals of terminology use, I think are still critically important, so people understand the definition between an attack, an attempted attack, a breach, an incident, a material incident. You know, and some of them are going to be contractually defined. Some of them are defined differently by all 50 states and and all of the all of the U.S. protectorates, and then not even to mention the other 200 plus countries around the world.
And we've got that problem too as a security community within ourselves. That even some of our terms are misused. I can't tell you how many times I hear patch management and vulnerability management are the same thing. No, they're patch management is a component of vulnerability management, but vulnerability management, such a broader term. And until we ourselves can fix those terms and understand the nuances between them, I have very little hope of helping those outside of our circle.
But some of that is also opportunistic. When you're answering the question, do I do penetration testing? And the answer is we do vulnerability scanning once a month. When you're on an RFP or something like that.
Yeah, I've seen that.
There's some, and this is in all directions, people trying to sell into organizations and people sign. You do definitely see answer shaping that I think is some of the root of that.
Right. That's I can't help when you see some of those things come back in an RFP or in a SOC report or something like that. It's like the role models. Go BS each other before you come in here. Don't BS me.
Right.
So Eric and Dan, strong point there. And I pivoting to the conversation back to how vendors fill things out. And this may or not be something I'm referring to myself on, but when answering those questions, I would create a comment side to try to put in detail to explain either A, how we do it or how we don't do it, right? And I was told, I can't say I was told, somebody I talked to said they were told, less is more, Brian. Like, take that out. As long as there's more yeses down here, I'm like, yeah, but we should explain, or not me, somebody should explain, a little more detail, because like you said, there's a lot of gray areas. It's goes back to the whole Senate hearing, yes or no on, do you think this solves all problems? And it depends.
Well, it depends. It does. And that's where it depends on what's your intent. If your intent is to create a partnership, then you've got to be open, because we're going to ask those questions back to you and we're going to want to know that color. But if you're up front right out of the gate, then you're starting to build that element of trust that you will be open about how you do things. Now, I will say that's the right mentality when dealing with not inside, but external audit, right? When you're dealing with auditors, you give them exactly what they're asking for, and then that's it. You don't explain any further. It's the same thing, saying,
go in front of Congress. Answer the question that is asked.
Yeah. You don't want to go in front of Congress and just have loose lips. And let me tell you a story. Back when the Constitution was signed, this is where we said, no, answer the question.
That's why they don't allow me in on audits. They're like, Brian, he did not ask about your crab cake recipe. Okay. Pivot. He specifically asked a yes or no. So this was all really good. Do you guys care if I pose another question?
Pose away.
Okay. So I liked how you guys answered both I can't say both the questions. I think Eric, the way you posed the question a little bit differently, I left it a little vague, so I appreciate the way you answered the question in regards to the vendor and the VAR relationship. Now, from the internal side at an organization, from the enterprise standpoint, and you look at the age difference, Dan, that you were going through, that the average age of a CISO is 48. It's by far the youngest on the scale of all five of those executive levels that we were referring to. And then, Eric, you were talking about the need, or maybe not the need, to be so pointed in the definitions of, what vulnerability management, what this is, what that is. I'm not referring to the fact that security is young, right? But the idea that security and the tools or the terminologies are kind of changing and adapting and developing to how the threat actors are operating or the techniques that they're using. Do you think that is a component of why the CISO age is not only younger, right, but also the experience as things change relatively quickly. It's the people that are using the tools and seeing it firsthand that are adapting and understanding the skills and the needs for the business. And as such, that is question one. And then question two, is there somebody in the organization that also needs to take on a mentorship role with that CISO to help explain the business risk up to the management? Because really that's what's going to help the business move forward with A, their risk appetite, B, risk avoidance, et cetera.
Yeah. So I'll take question two, subsection B, and the second point, which I think it's the job of the, I don't think the business should say, oh, we're going to partner you with so-and-so to teach you as the CISO. The CISO's got to go seek that out.
Yes.
You know, John Bingham at one point phrased it, I think, the best, that he was the chief storyteller. And I think there was another element to that, but that's, he moved mountains for his team. I'm moving boulders. I'm getting them what they need to do what they need. He just connected within the business. That is the CISO's role today. Now, granted, that probably it changes how much time you're spending there versus building a program, depending on as we go to the different CISO types and the maturity of the organization. But by and large, that has to fall on the CISO. And to the age thing, I think the age thing really just comes back to security hasn't been around that long. And I think our job as CISOs has to be very consultative. Is that a word? It is now. Consultative within the organization on helping them understand our world. Because there's a contingent of business leaders that I think still see security as, well, it's somebody in their basement with a hoodie that's banging on a keyboard. Well, that doesn't, that's not the model anymore. I mean, if you look at, and Brian, earmuffs on this one, CrowdStrike put out a report for 2021 for the kind of threat landscape and what they were seeing. And one, there was a picture in there that I absolutely loved. And it went through all of the different actors and the types of malware they were using. And then it started connecting the actors. And it's showing that this group actually helps this group and sells tools to this group. And and one of the biggest changes we're also seeing is that you have threat actors that are now selling targets. I'm going to be the one that breaks into the organization, but I don't want to do anything with it. I'm going to sell it over here that they're now going to monetize it and break in. And that's what we have to help the business see, that this is a well-oiled, structured ecosystem marketplace of adversaries that are working together to work to working against us to get into organizations and monetize what they're doing. And I thought it was a great depiction of that. And that's one that we need to be pushing up the chain to understand this is really what we're up against. This is why we're spending the money. This is why we're adding headcount. And again, it goes back to what John Bingham was saying. You're telling a story. You're explaining what we're up against, how big of the, I mean, I know we've talked about this before. That marketplace has better support for their products than the big box software retailers that we have within our organizations. It's amazing what they've amassed. Oh, yeah. And that's what we're up against. And that's why we're spending money. That's why we're trying to dynamically change organizations to better confront that. Soapbox done.
I doubt that.
Dan, before you jump in,
for now.
And Eric, not to reference my competitor, but I know the actual diagram you're talking about. And I'm going to say that somebody in my household thought it was very well put together. And you're right, the ability to, I think people get trapped in, I want to say like vendors become opportunistic. Maze ransomware just happened. Here comes a post in an article about Maze. Oh, Ryuk just happened. Here's a post about Ryuk. And it's almost like when people say they have alert fatigue, it's like, oh, I have threat actor landscape fatigue, right? But really, how are all these guys connected? And understanding that, looking at the diagram to see, in if you looked at the arrows, right? And how this connected with this, how this was connected with that group, and how this group created six different tools that can be used, and then all the different groups that are using those tools. It is a network out there, and it's a well-financed network. And I think for top management to see that from an organization standpoint, it starts to put it in better perspective of what your security team's up against.
And I mean, I'll add to it that SentinelOne did a phenomenal job with SolarWinds in decompiling that, and that the material that was put out was awesome. And that gave us the tools as CISOs to go up the chain and say, this is why that's such a big deal. And at the same time, this is what how we're positioning the organization to that. That's a risk that nobody anticipated. Well, I shouldn't say nobody anticipated. Somebody out there is going to raise their hand. Well, I told you about it 5 years ago. Okay, that's cool. But that's probably going to happen more and more. And that's why we have security in depth, multiple layers, and we're carving everything up. And SentinelOne did a great job of putting that back together to show how complicated that was. So if somebody was to, if you go up to the board and just say, yep, we had the vulnerable version. Well, that's only a part of the story, right? Without helping them understand how big of a deal this was, how well executed it was. It was phenomenal. I'm not putting it on the same level as a Stuxnet or something like that, but it was good. They did a great job. I mean, I guess it's always interesting to sit back and being in the defender role and looking at the attacker going, wow. Yeah, that was impressive. Good work on that one, but hats off. I mean, it was well orchestrated.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think when you say the Senate, the older gentleman, I forget his name, when he said, well, if everybody had firewalls and followed the NIST framework, then this wouldn't be an issue. Yes or no. It's a little bit gray there. Just like you said, if they came forward and said, did I have the bad version of the software? Yes, but there's a little more to it, right? So Dan,
but I really quickly though, on something you just said, I think this is one of the rare cases where the answer isn't necessarily, it depends. The answer is compliance and standards does not necessarily equate to security. People put all of their weight, and I am a big believer in standards. I'm a big believer in fundamental baselines for security programs, for quality programs, for, you know, for everything. They're there to get us a common bottom line, but it is not the be all end all, and nor is it the ultimate definition of what, insert whatever it is it's covering here. In this case, if I had followed NIST, that does not mean I am secure. Does not necessarily mean I am secure. So anyhow, continue. Sorry, Brian.
Well, actually, Dan, I was going to say, and now pivoting the question over to you that I'd asked Eric, and granted, it was question 2.56, addendum C. There was a lot to the question, but going back to the average, when we talked about the average age of a CISO, the idea of when you looked at the CISO's age is younger compared to the other executives, and then why that is, right? Is it a component of that security is becoming, that security programs are younger in their maturity because people are starting to take it more seriously? And then B, is there a need to have that mentorship or understanding of how to explain and sell into? And Eric, you did a great job of explaining even how John Bingham would do that, right? From a, when you called him the chief storyteller, but it really is. And I'm going to reference a movie here, Kaiser Sose, and it's how you, the usual suspects. It's how you tell the story, mm-hmm. right? And you watch at the end as he walks away with the limp, and the limp begins to go away and he's gone forever, right? And it's how you tell the story, right?
Yep.
And being able to articulate that, you know, up the chain, what does this person really want to see? Like when he was sitting there talking to this FBI agent or detective, he knew exactly what he needed to say and how to say it and correlate everything together. And at the end of it, he was using the blackboard behind the gentleman to tell the story, right? So I think I asked the question, and let me know if you need more context, but go ahead, Dan.
So, you know, I guess this has been a sign for me of the evolution of the CISO role and of security and of technology too, to some extent, but not quite yet. Is that the idea of the story is becoming more and more powerful, especially for those leaders that have become that are more business aware than they ever have been. You know, security comes up through technology. Our roots are in technology. Our roots are in, you know, in plunking on keyboards and making things work and metrics. And please, no offense to the to operational colleagues, people who truly do revel in. And make metrics work. But I think at the CISO and at the business interface level, the idea of taking those metrics and turning them into a narrative is more important than ever, because a business narrative, a metric of we stopped 4.3 million attempted attacks. So what? And I think we've talked about so what in this podcast before, but it's something I talk about a lot. So what? So does that mean I can't sell more things? Does it mean that customers are going to leave us? Does it mean that I can improve my credit rating as a company? Does it mean I can buy bonds at a lower rate? So what? And that's where we as business leaders, because I look at technology leaders, CISOs, all as business leaders now, we need to be able to talk about those things in business context and answer the so what, and that comes in the form of stories. Now, I will, on the flip side, stories are easily manipulatable too. People have long used stories, like Kaiser Sose, the story of Kaiser Sose, to make their point. And without some facts and data behind it, and without some trust of the storyteller, you do run the risk of getting, of being hornswoggled, of being manipulated as the story is told. So I think it's important to understand your storyteller in the same way. You know, there's a bit level of trust, and this comes back to the tenure question or the tenure facts. The fact that people in the CISO role aren't changing out every 18 months mean that they're able to build a longer runway of trust with their boards of directors, with their fellow C-level executives, and being able to be, then when the stories are told, have a they can have a better confidence that they're coming from a place of truth, a place of accuracy, than from a place of manipulation. Now, of course, there will always be people who use storytelling as a way to change the narrative in the way they want. And a good storyteller is, you know, salespeople are extremely good storytellers. That's what makes them great salespeople. How you use that power is up to you. And we as CISOs have to be that good of salespeople within our own organization. When I left the regulated world, it was my first role that was not in pharma, that was not in banking. And I realized that I had to become a much, much better salesperson. Because I didn't have regulations to say, oh, we got to do it because it's the law. Oh, why do we have to do these security things? Oh, but now I have to be able to sell it better. I have to be able to tell the story of why, and put it into business terms. And those business terms are, that's the game.
So I'm going to pose a question back to you then on that. And this goes to Eric and Dan again. So the ability to tell a story, right, becomes really, really important. The ability to relate it to something that everybody in the room can understand, regardless if it's the CEO, the CIO, or your team, right, below you that you're talking to. Eric, I'm going to use the background for this question, the Detroit Grand Prix, which I hope happens this year. As business begins to move forward faster and faster, moving to the cloud, using cloud compute, you could say it's like an F1 or a Grand Prix car, you know, it's moving faster and faster and faster. And in racing, the ability to drive fast, you know, is important, but the ability to also slow down is equally important. Some people say that security is like the brakes of the race car. Right? Allows you to hit the brakes when needed. But somebody else in your organization, that same meeting, might stand up and say, that's exactly what you are. You're the brakes. You slow us down, right? A, how do you combat that? And maybe refer to yourself more as the seatbelt connected to the brake system. Slow down just enough while also keeping the person safe from collision.
Yeah. So I'm gonna build on your racing analogy, and I'm going to change it. Instead of being a part of the car, that races are won or lost in the pits, and the pits take teams. That's what it's being a CISO is about, influence, right? and you're getting those around you to understand your story, understand your direction, and getting them to move with you. So in the context of cloud security and all of that, cloud is a huge enabler. And I believe we've talked about it here, or Dan and I in a, at another time have talked about, yes, cloud does a lot of enablement things. And there's also an element of opportunity for misconfiguration that is quicker to be realized as a risk in there. But at the same time, some of the security controls that it brings along with it, some of the way we can look at the data, carve it up, the quickness to response and all of that is untouched in what we can do on an on-prem model. So again, it's helping the team around you understand how to build those constructs and work together to all get moving in the same direction.
So, and then I'm going to pose that back to Dan. So me as the CIO, so you're telling me, Eric, that you're not the brakes, that you're not slowing me down?
I think a lot of times, if you get the right CISO, the CISO can actually be the gas that's pushing that car forward. Because if you look at some of our teams, if you're doing it right, your team should be on the cutting edge, understanding new technologies, new things before the business asks about them. If you are in a retroactive state, now granted, some of this is not necessarily dependent on the people on your team, because there are teams out there that aren't well funded, don't have enough people, that you're purely firefighting. Totally get that. But if you've got the team that can do it, you should be out in front answering questions before the business knows that they need to ask those questions. And in that point, you are a business enabler. You are pushing the team forward. You are the gas pedal that are pushing the car around the track.
I totally agree.
So Dan, on you, when it comes to the race car, so you said you agree, but the brakes, the seatbelt, or I guess now in Eric's terminology, the pits, meaning you're not the pits, but you're the team that when that car comes in, you're checking all the different diagnostics that were running on the vehicle while it was going around the track, tuning, filling up with gas, new tires on there so that you can stop in time and maneuver around.
Any indication or inclination that security and regulation and process don't have the potential to slow a process down in some small or material way is a fallacy. These things are inevitable. No, so I guess I'm clarifying, and I see Eric nodding, so I'm not violating his words. But I think there will be overhead, especially as organizations grow. We have this culture that has moved toward move fast and break things. And I hate to use Mark Zuckerberg's words because I just don't support his approach or his mindset. But I think in this case, it is what we as a culture have started doing more and more. However, there is a level of recklessness that goes along with that, and putting some guardrails on, putting some pathway on for organizations will give much, will long-term help organizations be able to succeed. There is some drag that goes along with that, but it shouldn't be brakes. It should be tires. If you look at it as, tires have different levels of slickness, and you use different, you use a different type of tire for different conditions. And, the CISO can help you decide which tires to put on at any given moment, or when you're taking this turn, or when you're in this type of condition, to make sure that the car doesn't slide off the track. And I just made an automotive analogy, perhaps for the first time in my life.
Bravo. Actually, I was going to transition that a little bit and saying, as the CISO, we become the pit box. You are watching, we watch the telemetry coming off of that car to do exactly what you're saying, Dan, is now it's time to put on these tires. Now it's time to bring the car back in. Hey, we have to make this wind change or the drag on the car to get it going around faster and, pull straighter out of the turns. We can make those adjustments because we have... Being in security is such an interesting spot because you have visibility across the entire organization, as opposed to more traditional IT areas that are very vertically integrated and I'm focused on this business line or this operation. We have to see it all, which puts us in a position of being able to generate the metrics, generate the telemetry, and adjust all aspects of the business.
Right.
Boom.
We might have to do like a special gathering of the minds for like the Grand Prix and put up like the whole racetrack and explain. Because Dan, you mentioned guardrails, right? And the guardrails are there for all the cars competing. And that's something I think when you're sharing information from company to company, you're helping protect the people in the stands, right? And you're helping protect the drivers of those organizations. Same thing you mentioned, Eric, you may have to call the car in early, right? And maybe the tires aren't worn out yet. Maybe there's still fuel in the vehicle, but you're picking up something, right, in one aspect of the vehicle that poses a risk to the car and the driver, and you bring them in and you make those changes. I didn't realize how the analogy of the race car, I didn't realize where it was going to go, but I really liked it. I really liked those answers.
It can go deep. I mean, you could start getting into some of the proactive natures that you're seeing. You're watching storm clouds come in, right? Yeah. So I'm going to pull my driver in now to put him on a different cadence with the rest of the group that's going to have to pit to change to rain tires, right? There's a lot of analogies there to what we do as CISOs.
And the other piece that I didn't mention is it's a long game. We play the long game. We don't play the short game. And this is where friction within organizations can happen. And it can look like, it can feel like breaks. But right. I think it really is about the long game and getting through, making decisions that might have some short-term pain, but ultimately long-term gain. And I think as CISOs, as security organizations as a whole, And I got to make myself not just say it's CISOs, because it really is about the whole security organization thinking about the best interests of the business and of the customers and using those to drive decisions and thinking about not just what's good for this quarter or not what's good for today or getting this system back up now, but looking at what it is the right thing to make the organization and our customers successful over the long haul.
That's such a great point on the long haul and all of that. I actually just had this conversation with one of our objectives, and one of the things that we want to work on is getting into more micro segmentation of the network. Mm-hmm. And it's a great objective. And my point to leadership was, this isn't something that we're going to do in a couple of months, because this one we are going to do, and I'll call it micro failures. Right? You will micro fail fast as you're testing, as you're figuring things out. But this is something that you have to meet with a scalpel rather than a nuke, because of the ramifications of that failure are so broad and so long reaching on what it could, kind of the getting into the domino effect, what it could take down. And that is exactly where we've got to be, Dan, is playing that long game, having the long-term vision, and being able to position ourselves on the day-to-day to still hit those long-term objectives.
And I'll get on the soapbox one last time as we're running out of time. And this, to bring this back around to those that sell us technology, those that are VARs, those that are partners, those that are perceived partners, those that we do work with outside the organization. If those organizations also came in with long-term mindsets, and I know this is hard to do when when the street is asking you for quarterly revenue numbers and quarterly, you have quarterly goals. It would be great if people came in and talked to me about the products that they have, the services that they have, and did so with the long game. And like you said, I think Eric, you said the telling thing is when somebody says this isn't for you, or think about this in the long term, or we'll come back in 2 years. When this is fully baked. But I would love it if we had more of those type of conversations. And also to give credit to back to the research discussions, the on the SolarWinds, the things that were published, those are where I find value in organizations, is being able to take those types of really deep and detailed and knowledgeable research. Those help my organization immensely, and those help build that level of trust and help us deliver to the businesses that we serve. And on that note, we've reached the end of yet another great security debate. Thank you. Thanks, Eric. Thanks, Brian. Your role today as chief question asker was really appreciated.
Very welcome. Thank you.
Cool. Well, thank you for listening, everybody. We will be back next time with another great security debate. In the meantime, if you have feedback, please email feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net. You can subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast application or on our website, www.greatsecuritydebate.net. And you can find us on Twitter @securitydebate. Thanks so much, and we'll see you next time.